Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, and we are joined today by two guests from Denmark. We have Margrethe Vestager, well known to the Brussels bubble from her roles in the European Commission, and now chair of the board at the Danish Technical University, and Dieter Brasso-Sørensen, who is the director of a think tank in Copenhagen. And they have just released a stocktaking report on the state of the EU and its international competitiveness. So we're very excited to be hearing from all of you. They had a conference a week ago. You can find the recordings on their website. But also, Margrethe, I wanted to ask you to set the scene for us to get going. You spoke about how Europe faces an external threat and also a lot of internal fragmentation. So what does that mean and how alarmed should we be?
Well, first and foremost, it's lovely to be here. And, you know, I think it's really good that we have this conversation about where we are and what we're doing, because we have faced so many crises in Europe in recent years. The financial crisis, the pandemic, energy crisis, obviously war in Ukraine, and the climate crisis as well. And we have managed quite a lot of that, and we have done that quite well. Now, the situation that we're in is as dramatic as anything that we've been faced with before, because all our dependencies, they have turned out to be weaponized against us. The gas dependency on Russia, the dependency on China for critical raw materials, production capacity market, the dependency on the US for security and technology. So if we want to play a role in the world, first, and second, maybe even more important, if we want to deliver to citizens the prosperity that can be transformed into welfare, which is basically the European social contract, then we need to do better, which means that it's not only a question of improving European security and defense, it's also a question of improving our competitiveness, making Europe work much better together. And since the competitiveness crisis is more asymmetrical than what we were ever faced with before, it's more complex. And because of that, it takes a bigger toll on member states actually to get there. So we have the work cut out for us.
Thanks for that. Dieter, what did you find when you surveyed the scene?
Well, in this is just to say that this is our first report on this stocktaking EU project. And the ambition of the report is really to sort of do an annual due diligence of the Commission's work to say across areas such as economy, competitiveness, digital transition, green transition and security, how far have we gone or how far have we come along on the policy objectives that were set out? So it's just to say that it's sort of in nature, it's inward looking and also a bit of a backward-looking exercise. But as you also mentioned, we really dive into the competitiveness questions in this report to survey the initiatives that were put out by the Commission in its first year. And I think one central finding is that when we look at the competitiveness agenda, where while European leaders has really sort of across the board applauded this report by Mario Draghi, they have been far less or more reluctant, I would say, to embrace his proposed cure. So a cure that both includes deeper integration and more collective financing. And what we discuss in the report is that we've seen the Commission really dive sort of head into this simplification agenda to start with low-hanging fruits. And I think that can be wise to start with initiatives that enjoy a broad political backing. It's also wise to dive into the part of agenda where you can really build momentum and get things going. A concern that we have in the report is that while we've seen these 10 proposed omnibus packages, that one should be careful to think that this alone can drive the growth that is needed in the European Union to build our competitiveness. And it's just to say that when you look at the estimates put forward by the Commission, according to the Commission, these 10 omnibus packages in combination will save cost for European companies of about 12 billion euros annually. So that's about 0.1% of European GDP. And that is, of course, meaningful, but it's not in itself a growth strategy. So that's also why, as we discuss in the report, that it's of fundamental importance that we ensure progress on sort of the deeper structural integration projects, such as completing the single market, building a capital markets union or savings and investments union, as it's called now. And that's really sort of, I would say, the test of political will and gut in the coming years.
Thank you. What would you say are your top three biggest impact recommendations?
What we say that we should look at in the coming years is that we should focus on further single market integration. And I think it's important to notice that that's not only a matter of sort of technicality. That is by now a deeply political question, because the areas where you need single market integration are essentially political, and you would need a nation state, member states to give up on sort of their national darlings when it comes to insolvency rules to build a genuine capital market. So that's one recommendation, but it's important to say that it almost has sort of a federalist or quasi-federalist sort of ring to it, because it's not only technical, it's also technical, but it's also deeply political to move forward on that agenda. And then a second recommendation is to say, well, the Commission is probably, or the EU is probably right in trying to sort of take part in this global competition to build forward-looking targeted industrial policy. But it's really important to understand that when we compare ourselves to our global competitors, we are a little behind on points from the beginning, because what you need to build industrial policy is that you need sort of financial muscles to back your industrial priorities, and you need the capability to set an industrial direction and to prioritize. And when we compare ourselves to China and the US, it's quite evident that when we look at the common pool of money, so it's not that there is no money in Europe, but when we look at the common pool, so the European budget, it's relatively limited compared to the US federal budget, compared obviously to China's state budget. And we also have a lesser degree of coherence between the state level and the market. So we're just structurally challenged in building such an industrial policy, which means that there's really a need for sort of bold moves from the Commission when it comes to creating a targeted industrial policy that doesn't focus on everything, but actually pick out sectors that the EU should invest in. And those sectors should, in our mind, be sort of innovative technologies. So that means that we have to let go of some of the technologies that we are currently supporting under the EU's industrial policy. I mean, solar being the obvious one. So I think those two. And then the third one that we singled out is that we need a much more coordinated approach to our investment in defense. So we're seeing a surge in defense investments now across the board, for good reasons, for the reasons that Margrethe already alluded to in the beginning. But we're lagging behind on the coordination of those investments. And there, I think the Commission could also play a part.
And two good examples to illustrate Dieter's point. I think the first one is that the Commission, when I was there, we set the goal that Europe should go from producing 10% of the world semiconductors to 20%. The Commission could only do European legislation that was targeting sort of the knowledge infrastructure, but not the real infrastructure, you know, enabling forgeries, packaging facilities, all of that. When it came to actually establish more production on ground, it was fully dependent on national state aid. So, of course, I was responsible for enabling that state aid. Colleagues of mine were responsible for sort of the knowledge infrastructure about how to make sure that we can get cutting edge semiconductors produced in Europe. But it was never a truly European strategy, because you were always dependent on whether or not member states would make it a priority for semiconductor production to be increased in their territory. Second thing would be on the defense spending. Now, when all member states have pledged that they will increase to 3.5 plus 1.5%, there ought to be a European push for what you could call a European DARPA, that a fraction of those new defense costs, that they are directed to innovation that is wild. Because so much innovation in the US comes from the fact that you have this specific pot of money that enables innovation. And the minute it turns out to be something valuable, the US military, they're willing to say, we'll buy that. And that makes other investors come. So there are a number of lost opportunities when it comes to making sure that part of the European quest for better competitiveness is truly European. And I think the problem is that a number of countries, they are sub-optimizing, because they tend to think that their domestic issues, and there are many domestic issues in Europe right now, that they can be solved with a domestic focus. But the paradox is that when you have a domestic challenge, very often it needs a European solution. As we saw it under the pandemic, under the energy crisis, and as we see it now in supporting Ukraine.
Just to add to this, I think the point Margrethe is making about how do you raise the national investment. So there are a double issue here. It's both how do you ensure that the investments made in Europe, whether that be on the European level or the national level, whether they are directed to strategic important priorities. So how do we ensure that they're coordinated and flowing in the right direction? But I think the point Margrethe is making is so important that we also need instruments. And I think those needs to be built, especially when we rely on state aid as sort of the financial backbone of our industrial policy, and that is how it's carved out by now, we need to give a hard think about what can we then do on a European level that actually incentivizes national spending. Because what we're looking, and when we look across the European landscape, we're seeing a lot of squeeze governments. So they are in sort of a national financial pinch point. So they are reluctant to spend. So if you look at the Commission's latest state aid report, the data is actually showing that not only is sort of on a general level state aid investments not accelerating, they are not accelerating in the areas that we need them to accelerate in, whether that be a defense or a clean tech, so the areas of strategic importance. So there, I think there is really a sort of a space for the EU to move into to ensure that you provide the right incentives for the nation states to invest, as long as you rely on state aid as sort of the financial backbone of a common European industrial policy.
Margrethe, when you were executive vice president and the commissioner in charge of state aid, you really worked hard to enforce the level playing field and keep countries with deeper pockets from squishing out others who they might view as competitors. How do we balance that need to have an even field of play and also get more resources in?
Well, the first obvious question is to make much more of this European, to sort of evacuate the territory of state aid. Because the reason why state aid can become very toxic is that you cannot say what one country can do, everybody can do, because maybe only that one country can afford it and can pour money into their own industries to the detriment of countries and competitors around them, may be part of the same ecosystem that can then be completely unbalanced. So first things first is, of course, to see what can we do at a European level to strengthen our ecosystems, our infrastructures when it comes to industry. And the second thing is, of course, to make sure that we're in control, that we know what we're doing, because there's so much state aid in Europe. It's not that it's state aid free compared to the US or to China. The difference is that it's transparent what we're doing. And I think that's the second really, really important thing to maintain, is that taxpayers need to know where their money is going. Because otherwise, there is a risk of collusion between policy and big business, and that will not serve an industrial renaissance in Europe. And actually, European industry is picking up all the doom and gloom. I think part of it is actually not really what is the state of play. And second, there is kind of a good place where competition and a modern industrial policy can come together. So instead of thinking about sort of old school politicians choosing their favorite businesses, thinking about politicians enabling businesses. I think if you look at the AI efforts, the AI factories, the AI gigafactories, access to data, that is an industrial policy that is modern, because it enables different businesses actually to have a go at it. And then hopefully for customers to act as their anchor customers to help them develop.
And just to add to that, that's also why, and a recommendation that we have in the report, it's so crucially important that the Commission sort of sit at that table and ensure sort of a relatively rigorous scoping of the industrial policy. So one thing is the digital area, but also looking at the clean tech area. I think we've seen the Commission being quite adamant that European industrial policy should have a scoping that is, broadly speaking, clean competitiveness at the header level. A concern that we raise in the report is then when you look at the concrete policy measures that are allowed under that broad policy framing, it's not entirely evident, I would say, that all the tools allowed are serving the purpose of, let's say, clean competitiveness. I think an example of this is, for example, this new state aid framework that we're discussing under the Clean Industrial Deal, which allow member states to subsidize energy-intensive industries' power bills with up to 25% of wholesale prices. That might serve a purpose, but it's not, strictly speaking, I would say, the most efficient way to bring about decarbonization of energy intensive industries. And I think you could make the same argument about the steel tariffs, which are currently being negotiated and are not in place yet. But it's just to say that this political landscape that Margrethe also pointed to before, the Commission really have to sort of obviously strike a balance, but I think also play the part or play the role to say we ensure that this has sort of a direction, that European industrial policy cannot be everything. It cannot be all sectors and it cannot serve all purposes. It has to serve, when we look at the clean tech part, it needs to serve clean competitiveness, both at the headline level, but also on the proposed tools.
We talk a lot about foreign dependency, non-EU dependency. You said earlier that solar panels are an area where it's okay to import the components we might want for electrification and the green transition. How do you two see the balance between what needs to happen here and how we reduce dependencies? And Margrethe, I remember you going to Latin America to try and find alternate sources of minerals. So is it a matter of not so much reshoring as just changing up the supply chain?
Well, I think it's both. As a headline, Europe should not try to be independent. It's extremely costly, and it's also not possible. Simply full stop. But we can be more independent. And we can be a much more heavy player in other people's value chains so that we strengthen that idea of mutual dependencies. But first and foremost, we need to diversify, like we did with gas, from a number of countries being 100% dependent on Russian gas till now, where I think we have gas imports from 10 different suppliers. That is the way to go. And the same goes for a number of the critical raw materials. The point is, of course, that we also need to use European raw materials. It cannot be not in my backyard approach here. We need to show that, yes, we are also willing to have the cost of extracting raw materials and to do the processing in a responsible manner. Because only if we can do that ourselves is it trustworthy that we can work with partners around the planet and do the same thing. And you know, the start of the Swedish presidency some years ago, well, that was exactly that they announced that they had found, I think, all the most important critical materials in the northern part of Sweden, only it would take 10 years to start extracting. So I think that's a very important point that we need also to do this ourselves. And the second thing is that in doing so, well, we need to work with new partners around the planet. Trade agreements that are being forged right now, Canada, Mercosur, India, obviously key to this. Because we need to trade much more, also for the simple reason that the huge majority of global growth will happen outside of Europe in the years to come, both because of the demographic decline, but also because emerging economies, they become real strong economies, and we want to be really well connected with them.
Thanks for that. In the next part of our podcast, I want to talk about Denmark and the lessons it can teach the rest of Europe about how to join forces and how to be mindful of sovereignty and also of being part of something bigger. Denmark has opt-outs that no other current member of the EU has from the euro and from, I believe, certain parts of defense, and yet is very enthusiastic about joining forces collectively. So how does that work? Is it by having the sovereignty, it feels more comfortable joining up? Margrethe, you were a Danish politician before you moved up to the EU level. How do you see it?
I think that it has changed enormously over the years, because now when you don't, or very rarely, at least in the Danish context, see money. And when you travel in Europe, you don't see money. You don't physically have money in your hand. I think the euro opt-out is not as important to people anymore. It's also very difficult to take it away because people don't see it. They don't see the benefit because they won't have to exchange. But I think the Danish approach has very little to do with the opt-outs and much more to do with realizing that, yes, you're a small, strong nation, but you're so much stronger when you're with other people. And I think also an increasing trust in the European democracy, that also small countries can be seen and heard have their views being part of the direction being set. And I think that sort of self-esteem is really, really important. I think the Danish presidency was very successful. It was also sort of very much, we have done this before, we can do this again, we will be great at it. And it's not an arrogant approach. It's just sort of an, of course we can do this. And I think that's a good thing to take inspiration from, that, yes, we can do this. Because if that is the atmosphere and the spirit all over Europe, well, even these very complex challenges that we're talking about, they become so much easier.
No, I agree. And if you look, there was a survey put out last year, which showed that the Danish support for the EU and trust in EU institutions is historically high. And that's been sort of an upwards curve since, sort of a general upwards trend since Brexit, as we've seen across other member states as well. And I think what Margrethe is saying, that these external pressures are of course sort of continuing that upwards line. So we are seeing a very strained transatlantic relation. There's the war in Ukraine. Obviously, there's, from a Danish point of view, the Greenlandic issue that sort of showcases that European alliances, other European leaders are important to the Kingdom of Denmark. And on the Greenlandic issues, probably are absolutely our closest alliance partners. So one thing is sort of the external pressure. I also think that a factor in this is also that we have now and have had for the past couple of years, a government who has dared to say that the European project is neither far away, it's not necessarily only boring, it's actually important, it's actually also sort of part of the political rhetoric coming from the government. I think a quite telling example is that the current Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, she went from a couple of years back saying that, or at least sort of heavily indicating that the EU was something that she would be very reluctant to waste her time on, and the Danes should at least not waste our money on this project, to now being sort of a great proponent of not only the EU as such, but also European alliances and parading with other European heads of state. And I do think that that shift in sort of political direction setting from the government level in Denmark has also added to this buildup of that sense that Europe is important. The EU is probably not only boring, it's probably also quite sort of necessary and valuable. And that I think is also a shift in Danish politics, where if you look a couple of years back, or probably 10 years back, there was this sense that this is something that the government will take care of for you. You don't need to bother with the Brussels question. We have our opt-out, as you say, we have guarded our sovereignty, so you can sort of relax and look the other way. And that's not the way the EU and Europe is portrayed in Danish politics and especially by the government any longer.
And I think also here, we should think about this differently. Somebody told me recently, proud, 80% of people in my country, they support the euro. And I'm like, why do you ask that question? You know, ask something random in person in North Carolina, do you support the dollar? They would be completely flabbergasted. Well, why is this person asking me this? The dollar is the dollar. And I think we need to move on to say, listen, the euro is the euro. More. Go. More. You know, that sort of, we don't have to keep revisiting old questions that are settled. I think that is an important point for Europe to do something that is specific, that can be seen as something that actually serves everybody well.
A North Carolina native, happy to hear my home state in the European news. Denmark is often held up as a model for its flexicurity reforms. Do you think this is exportable, or it really only works because of your particular local conditions? This idea that companies and workers can change with less disruption and fewer protections in the spirit of more economic prosperity.
But I think the point here is that there's still a lot of protection, but it's society that protects you. And we've been at this for more than 100 years. And when you have been exercising a muscle for 100 years, you get really good at it. So it has become completely integrated that, of course, the gains from increased productivity, those gains, they are being shared. And I think that fundamental culture has developed a sense of trust between employers and employees. And it's, you know, you can't even put a value to this. It's so important. I think that it would be great if others would take that inspiration and try to take some of those steps, realizing, of course, this is really difficult. Because if you do not have a trusted relationship, but everything comes from laws, that are built up to protect you, which adds a lot of inflexibility. Everything can become really static. You know, we hear about systems where businesses, they don't want to hire anybody because they say, oh, but we don't know if we have employment for these people or tasks that they should do for the next many years. That, of course, is a barrier also to European flexibility. But the Danish flexicurity comes with sort of the society backing you up. If you lose your job, well, you will have a subsidy coming from the state. And I think that is the point. And I do think that it's exportable, but it takes much more than just new laws. It takes new way of doing things, and it takes the building of a trust that the gains of increased productivity is actually being shared.
No, I completely agree. And I do think looking at that Danish model or the flexicurity model, I do think that if we treat it as a product, there's nothing wrong with the product. So in that sense, it's exportable. I think the question here is also, as Margrethe is alluding to, is whether there are countries that are willing to import it because it takes a build up of societal trust to be able to make the shift. And I don't think it's a failure of the flexicurity model that it's not sort of being exported to other countries in the EU as of now. But it's, I think, really on the flexicurity model, this is a matter of long-term sort of incremental steps towards a more flexible way of hiring and firing and conducting labor policies, and not a rapid sort of revolution where you shift one model for sort of a rule-based or a regulation-based model for this more flexible trust-based model. I think that will not happen when you look at the countries that are sort of in back of mind of this discussion, such as France and onwards, that this is not sort of shifting one model for the other. This is a prolonged sharing of best practices, I would say.
And also, one of the reasons why it's difficult to export it is that it's another division of power, because you put a lot of power in the hands of employers, organizations, and unions. They decide. Politicians do not decide. So there are areas where politicians have willingly stepped back and, you know, left power with the parties of the labor market. And I think that's a very difficult thing to do nowadays for politicians. Also because a lot of legislation is being decided in the European Parliament and the Council of Ministers. So if you have a national parliament, should they give up more power for the labor market to work with the parties of the labor market? I think that is another barrier that is really, really difficult to pass.
We started in the middle because it's such an interesting topic, but I'm thinking now we should back up. About 15% of our listeners are in the US. We've got people all over Europe. So could one of you give just a high level overview of what flex security means? We've talked about making it easier to hire and fire. You've talked about involving the unions more, but there's still rules, right? It's not just trusting it'll all work out.
No, there are laws, of course, but the laws, they are taking care of the fringes, because basically employers and unions, every fourth year, they make an agreement about what should be the increase in salaries. Should you have another day off to take care of a sick child? Should you have more holidays? What kind of flexibility do you need in the workday? Everything related to work can be discussed by unions and employers' organizations. And those unions who are doing these negotiations, they would organize about more than 50% of the relevant people in the area, which means that the level of membership is still quite high in Denmark. And that means that politicians, they would sort of look at what is happening. Maybe they would codify something if it has been going on for a very, very, very long time. But otherwise, they would, you know, say, hands off. This is for the parties of the labor market. But they would still be sort of the backup function. Because if you're being fired, and it is very flexible, actually, to fire people, of course, you have rules. If you have done something wrong, you need to be given a warning, that, and so on and so forth. It's not the Wild West. But if you lose your job, the states, the society will step in and they will make sure that you're provided for in a certain period of time. And there will be a system that enables you to find another job in another business. And it's also reflected in the vocational training system that businesses, they take in apprentices knowing that they may not be the people giving them permanent employment after they have finished their education. But it's part of the responsibility among employers to make sure that the vocational training system actually works. Because you may train someone that I will hire, I will train someone that you will hire later on. And that gives, I think, a commitment, both with unions and employers' organizations, to take responsibility and not just look at politicians and pledge and lobby for better conditions.
Super interesting. I've been a citizen of Belgium for almost 10 years now, and the local approach is very different when it comes to trust, particularly between the unions and the government. There's very much a sense of it's kind of the opposite of that optimism that another job will appear. It's what if something doesn't happen? So as we talk about making Europe more dynamic, is there any way to get that Danish optimism? You mentioned trust, but is it something that other countries could take? Can you think of one or two specific concrete steps to help encourage it?
Well, I think when it comes to building that European optimism, I think, well, obviously it could come from the member states, as you say, and we could look to member states where things are going relatively well, economically speaking, and on societal trust. And we can pick Denmark as an example and then say, can we build on that model? But I do think what is also needed is that we need at the European level sort of optimistic or at least sort of a visionary narrative of where we're going and why. So right now, and I think it has to be that way in the way the political and especially sort of the geopolitical environment is right now, it is a kind of a crisis prone mood. So not necessarily that we muddle through, but we do go from one crisis to the next one and almost from the one truth social post to the next. I do think the Commission has also a role to play there in setting sort of a future vision for where's the EU going. And I think what we saw a shift, and that's sort of my reading, but a shift from the von der Leyen 1 Commission to the von der Leyen 2 Commission was that we actually saw that an attempt to build that in the von der Leyen 1 Commission around the European Green Deal, and we don't need to repeat that, but that was at least sort of growth plan and a growth strategy that said, well, we will be the first major economy that decouple economic growth and fossil fuels, and we'll build a growth plan around that, and we'll build new sectors and focus on clean tech and whatnot. And now we're seeing the industrial policy to follow that, which I think is probably wise. But I think with the shift that has then happened with the von der Leyen 2 Commission is that you have this narrative of competitiveness, and that is a zero-sum game. So your competitiveness increases as other economies' competitiveness decreases. And it's a narrative that's strictly, I think, if you sort of boil it down, it's very much that we need to stop the bleeding. So we need to stop losing to China, we need to stop losing to the US, and we need to fence ourselves in terms of economic security and so forth. So it's much more defensive. And I understand why that shifts have been made. But I do think that there's also a role for the Commission to try to put forward sort of a more, in your words, a more optimistic or more sort of forward-looking narrative around what is it that we should use this European project for. And I do think there are a lot of solid bricks to build from. I mean, we have a great quality of life. We have not only in Denmark, but across the board, a high level of societal trust. So it's not that there is not a lot to build from, but I do think that that narrative also needs to be at the European level.
And I think that what one should notice is when something new is happening. Because, you know, there's this old saying, if you keep doing the same thing and expect another outcome, well, it's not so good. Anyway, two new things to watch. One is the European Scale-Up Fund, because it's one of those things that, you know, when I cleaned my office, I left this template on my table, say, listen, we need to do this. So instead of building another fund within the Commission ecosystem of funds, which is a bit like give me your money and I'll spend it slowly, saying, listen, we need to make a fund that works on market terms for those 5 critical sectors that really need investment in order to scale up. So it is primarily privately financed. It will be with a third-party professional fund manager. And as things stand now, it will be launched, I think, before summer, which is really, really fast in European terms. Second, the 28 regime. The European Parliament, they are positive. The proposal is expected this quarter. This idea that you can be EU incorporated as from day one into how you start a business, how you have a business, and how you end a business. That is really good news, because there's no way that you can harmonize all of that between the 27. And when you talk with American friends about this, they say, Delaware. That is kind of their way of understanding what this is. And there will be a lot of problems and a lot of discussion and what do I know? But the point is to notice something new specific is happening in order to make good things stay and begin in Europe.
The 28th regime, discussion is so fascinating. We'll be coming back to that at Bruegel and here on this show. I will point out that the Parliament recommendation is for a directive with maximum harmonization. So there would still have to be 27 versions of it, even if the intention is good.
Yeah, I'd say that a directive sort of defies the purpose, which is to have, you know, one rule all over the union.
It would be 27, 28 regimes.
Yes.
We've been hearing the commission may come out with a regulation. That's what the Justice Commissioner Michael McGrath has been suggesting. But watch this space. We'll be coming back to it. In the last part of our podcast, I want to keep this forward-looking spirit. Also have to ask about tech. Margrethe, during your tenure, the EU really tried to stand up to American big tech. I think we can agree the track record has been mixed. And then any stock taking involves looking at how do we work with the big American tech companies? Do we partner with them? How do we use their cloud services? How do we handle the data issues? So what do you guys make of this?
Well, I think first and foremost, you enforce your own laws. They're there for good reasons. And they didn't come out of nowhere. You know, basically everything else was tried before you started legislating. Now you have copyright legislation, data legislation, you have the Digital Services Act, Digital Markets Act, the AI Act as core. You need to enforce those laws because Europeans, they were promised that it would be safe to use tech services and that the market would be open and contestable. These are normal things to ask. There's nothing extremist about the tech legislation in Europe. It's all normal that you want your services to be safe to use, that they're not harmful to your society or to your mental health. That your market is open and contestable is, you know, first things first, when you want innovation, is that you can actually get to market. Second is to promote European alternatives because they do exist. And the tech race is not over. Really, really important. Also, the AI race, not over. I think really important that someone say, yeah, we want to be the anchor customers for European tech developers. And then, of course, thirdly, have a life that's not digitally dependent. You know, have a life. And I think that's also a very important message also to Europeans. All this technology is not about your life being limited to watching a screen. No, on the contrary. Technology should serve you as a person, as a citizen, this society. And I think that is 100% legitimate. I think much of the US pressure comes from the fact that big tech has an excellent business in Europe and they don't want to see that go.
No, I completely agree, but both on the value of having a life, agree on that one, but also on the point of strict enforcement, to simply have the guts to say that we actually do have rules in this area. It is regulated. So this is about enforcing the rules that we have, even though that might come at a cost. But to circle back to what Margrethe said in the very beginning, was also what we've seen in recent years is that we've seen these global competitors being increasingly willing to weaponize our dependencies. And that is, of course, also evident in tech. And that just means that there's also a cost issue here because we do need to build up or we do need to limit dependencies and thus also build up European capabilities, not only in limited emerging technologies where we could potentially compete globally, but also in the digital infrastructure. And that will be costly. So if we don't want to rely on China for 5G infrastructure and we don't want to overly rely on the US when it comes to cloud services or AI, that means that we do need to build up those capabilities in Europe. And what we lack in Europe is that we don't have the private companies to run with this innovation in Europe. So we need to, it's really sort of, it's not from nothing, but we don't, what you have in the US is that you have the US big tech who can innovate and has shown that they're very good at innovating. And here, I think we're in an area where we need to accept that a lot of public money will need to flow into this area to build up the companies that will then need to ensure the innovation further down the line. So it's just to say that this is an area where we need to really sort of build in Europe.
I differ just a tiny bit on this because I see that a lot of the innovation in big tech comes from acquisitions because Europe is a very innovative continent, but a lot of that innovation goes to the US. They get excellent offers from big tech and they very often find it difficult to get their financing at a European pace. So as Dita said initially, you know, the structural things, making the digital single market work, make the savings and cap and investment union work. These are structural issues that are urgent in order for that innovation not only to start in Europe, but also to scale in Europe. And when it comes to technology, you know, some say, for instance, I think Swatch Group, they have a cloud offer, which is the same price point as AWS. But then say, yeah, but they don't have all the services connected. No, but do you use the 200 services of AWS? And once you're in there, do you think that you can ever leave? You know, I think it's also very much sort of the approach by European businesses to say, maybe we should put our data where our mouth is and stop just talking about European digital sovereignty, but also say, actually, to get there means that we take a different decision today about where our data is stored, where we get our cloud capacity or our compute capacity.
Yeah, it seems like keeping that technology innovation that does develop here in Europe might be the way to go. There's such a debate right now between the voices saying Europe overreached, there's too much tech regulation, anyone doing innovation is going to go in the US because they don't want to mess with it. But then you do have all of these values and all of this desire to insulate Europe from the downside of this innovation. It's like they're both important conversations, but they almost don't overlap. So maybe keeping new technology at home and switching to things here might be a way through.
But part of that discussion is so, so defensive. You know, the AI Act doesn't touch innovation. It doesn't touch research. It's basically just asking you to know what you're doing when you're touching the essentials of human lives. That is normal. That's not crazy or overreach or any of the sort. The Digital Markets Act is asymmetrical. The biggest powers, they get the biggest responsibility. Same go with the Digital Markets Act. In order to give space for businesses actually to grow, because it has very little effect when a small business would do the same as a big business. When the big business do it, it will have completely detrimental effects on market dynamics. So I think part of that is also saying, bah, no, I cannot be bothered. So now I continue that overregulation lingo that has, you know, just kept the talk going while I do something else. And I think that is a problem, that we don't get the real discussion about what is it that we're doing, because it's 100% legitimate to say things may be possible in a simpler way. Because when you have legislated for a long time, you will have overlaps, you will have slightly different wording of things, you will have things that doesn't really fit together. You can do it second or third generation of legislation, that makes things simpler. You can make it digital ready. A lot of legislation back in the days, of course, was not made digital ready. 100% legitimate, get the job done. But the real things, as Dita said initially, are the structural things, that capital will flow to you as investment, and that there is a market access for you. Those are the things that really make a business grow.
On market access, we've touched here and there on capital markets development, the different initiatives out there. This is an area that I work on, and a thing that comes up over and over again is how in Denmark and Sweden, not only do you have a strong track record of capital market investment and actualized, let's call it pension money that is invested in the stock market and things, but you also have a societal comfort with owning parts of companies and equity risk. And I've been really struggling with how do you export that comfort with that type of risk elsewhere? Because otherwise, we can talk about lowering barriers till we're blue in the face. If people don't see equity market investments as an appropriate level risk for them, we're not going to get the cultural shift we're looking for.
Well, do you think there's a lot of chatter right now about the Nordic moment and what can you sort of learn from the North, and could the Nordic countries pull forward and sort of be that shining example? But as you also touch upon, this is also a trust issue, right? Or sort of a cultural issue. And here I think the institutional investors in the Nordic countries, the pension funds being absolutely central to this discussion, has been sort of quite an essential piece of building that trust, that you've built a whole institutional system around equity owning, so it's implicit through the pension systems. I wouldn't say that in that sense that the Danish society is overly entrepreneurial, and it's not that all people own stocks on their own, but you do have these institutional systems that are put in place and then ensure that you have these investments made.
And also, I think it's important that we do not see countries or regions as somebody that we should copy.
Exactly.
I think that we should take the inspiration, because the context will be very different. Now, we talked about the pension funds, we have talked about the flexicurity, and there is a Nordic thing. It's not the same in Greece. And Greece, they have been doing tremendously since those days where there was talk about them leaving the euro to where they are today. Portugal, same story. They have really, really made the best of their EU membership. Same goes for Poland. But they have a different context. They may take the inspiration, maybe we should consider this or this or this, but in our own way. And I think that is part of the magic of the European Union, that we can have something that unites us, but there's still room for doing things with your specific culture, historical context, climate, composition of your economy. And I think that's absolutely crucial, because things that happens in the Nordic countries may not at all be possible in France, in Southern Germany, in Italy, where do I know? So I think that sort of much more sort of general round discussion about how to be inspired is more important than say, oh, you go copy that. They're successful. I don't think that would ever work.
We're coming to the end of our stock taking, to borrow your term. So I'd love to ask each of you for closing thoughts. If there's one thing you would like the Europeans and non-Europeans among our listeners to take away as a goal or an inspiration for where we go next?
Well, that's a good question. I think one thing that's also sort of as quite central inside of the report or takeaway from the report is the vast degree to which external pressures over the last year has really sort of shaped the European Union. So we see quite creative thinking. So we see enhanced cooperation on financing for Ukraine. We've seen emergency powers being used to ensure that we have defense investment initiatives. And I think one thing that's really important there is to say that really also goes to show how agile and adaptable the European system is. And I think there is a lot of talk about the EU being too rigid and too slow, and there are too many administrative burdens, and that might all be true to some degree. But it's also important, I think, to celebrate that we actually have a political system that has adapted through several crises, the COVID crisis, the energy crisis, the war in Ukraine. It's becoming increasingly sort of a more coherent and present international and geopolitical voice. And that has happened in a relatively short time span. And that shows, I think, a really important and valuable piece of how the EU also works, that it is a novel political system and it is still moldable. And I think that's an important insight to bear with us also.
Well, first and foremost, Dieter and her team, they have made a wonderful report. It's a good read. It's short. It has great graphics. You know, you get an overview. So I'd highly recommend it. You find it online. Second thing is that Europe is moving. Europe is not static. Europe has not lost it. Europe has not given up. It's not perfect, but it's moving. And it's moving to change for the better. And I think that's just very encouraging and a good invitation for even more people to come on board and be part of that move to the better.
Thanks very much. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. We will link to the Danish think tank's stock-taking report in the show notes. And I'd like to give a huge thanks to our guests, Ditte Brasse Sørensen and Marita Vestager. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.